Mother Earth says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. And Father Sky says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. Creatures say, take good care of us. Please do not hurt us. Hey, hey, yo. Hey, yo, hey, yo, hey, yo. And we are here to be ourselves, to be with one another, to be with our surroundings, to be. And we are here to take care of ourselves, to take care of one another, to take care of our surroundings.
Greetings. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat-Kitishi Native American Center. We are broadcasting on RFPI, Radio for Peace International, Global Community Radio. Akwe, welcome. This is your host, Ones Pritzker. Wolf Mountain Radio focuses on protecting Mother Earth, defending Native lands and Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices presents the situations facing Native peoples throughout the world with Native news, interviews, music, commentaries, and investigative reports. This program serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and the traditional cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Please listen now to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Ho, Kanawantakwasin, to all of our relations.
Many years ago, in a land so free, freer than we know it today, the buffalo ran free and the eagle soared up high. Waters ran clear into the sea. Now the land before us means much more to us than ever before. People have given their lives to protect it. Remember the older ones once more. Here's the pen, here's the yes, put your name on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here. Please sign here, put your name on the line. Don't worry guess is you were once a native man. The times have changed, and so has the land. People are needing the resource that it gives. You'll be better off, oh, the life that you could live. Here's the pen, here's the X. Put your name on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here. Please sign here. Put your name on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here. Many years ago, in a land so free, freer than we know today, the buffalo ran free, and the eagle soared so high, and the waters ran clear into the sea. Here's the pen, here's the etch. Put your name on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here. Please sign here. Put your name on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here. Please sign here. Put your family on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here. Please sign here. Put your people on the line. Don't worry about the fine print, please sign here.
Music from Haudenosaunee Oneida singer-songwriter Joanne Shenandoah from her Canyon Records CD entitled Once in a Red Moon. That particular song was entitled Please Sign Here, and that's in reference to more than 500 treaties between our sovereign separate nations and the governments they now call Washington and Ottawa. We are now listening to Program 7 of Yat-Kitishi Native Center Wolf Mountain Radio's interview with environmental community activist Joy Ezell. Great greetings and hello, everyone. Welcome to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. In today's program, we are honored to share a conversation with environmental community and peace activist Joy Ezell. Joy shares Yat-Kitishi Native Center's concern for protecting Mother Earth and promoting environmental social justice. Joy Ezell's activism exemplifies the important ethic of thinking globally and acting locally. Some of the issues she is fighting with her community organization include environmental, economic, and social impacts of the multinational corporation PG&E Buckeye Paper Mill, a proposed 800 megawatt coal-fired power plant, and United States military plans to locate a cruise missile bombing range in her area. These and other issues are topics of today's conversation when Joy visited us here at Yat-Kitishi Native Center. Yat-Kitishi Native Center's concern for protecting Mother Earth and the well-being of all life, in keeping with the Indigenous ethic of caring for future generations, is why we are honored to be part of the worldwide environmental justice anti-globalization movement. Most every Wolf Mountain Radio program focuses on some aspect of defending our biosphere as well as promoting sovereignty and self-determination of traditional cultures around the world. I personally have had the honor over the past 35 years to see firsthand and fight against many cases of environmental and social injustices in different parts of the globe. In my travels, I have met many fine and courageous people who are working to create a better world. Each Earth warrior, I've met, renews my energy to continue to defend Mother Earth. Joy Ezel is one such friend. Joy Ezel and I share a similar background and experiences as Earth justice activists. We both grew up in rural areas where agriculture and forestry dominate the political and economic society. Like feudal kingdoms, agribusiness and forest industries rule the region. Anyone who questions those dragons does so under great threat. As a forest ecologist who has spent much of my life fighting forest industries around the world who destroy and pollute traditional cultures and ecosystems, Joy Ezel's battle against the Buckeye pulp and paper mill is particularly special to me. This company is responsible for serious environmental health impacts from their poisonous discharge effluents that contaminate the region's creeks and rivers and poison underground aquifer needed for drinking water. The mill also is the engine that drives the excessive and unsustainable cutting down of forests, raping the land. Historically, the landscape of the region now called North Florida, where Joy lives, was a beautiful ecosystem with a rich diversity of plant and animal species. Variations in topography, soil types, and hydrology created a unique watershed. It was first home to ancient culture peoples, such as the Apalaches, Tallahassees, Timucuas, and other tribal nations who lived in peace with nature. The arrival of Spanish explorers to the so-called New World did have an impact on the land, but the forest and wet prairie creek environment was still able to survive. Southeast Indians, who are now known as Florida Seminoles and Yuchi Creeks, for generations lived in harmony with this land. Early white settlers, like Joy Ezel's family, found the region a near paradise. Large cypress trees and longleaf pine, hardwood hammocks, marshes, creeks, and freshwater springs allowed rural communities to flourish. Coastal areas had the bounty of the Gulf of Mexico. Now, this once beautiful area, like so many places around the world, is under assault. This biologically fragile area is quickly being destroyed. The unique old-growth forests have been cut down to feed the ever-demanding pulp and paper industry's greed for timber. PG&E's Buckeye Mill is like a giant vacuum cleaner sucking up the forests. It leaves a scared landscape. So-called reforestation is nothing more than agro-industrial plantations, monoculture tree farms, which depend upon heavy inputs of chemical fertilizers, herbicides, and insecticides, now predominantly the landscape. Wiped out are the unique species of fauna and flora that once supported a diverse variety of wildlife. Hazardous waste, such as highly toxic dioxins, which are carcinogenic and mutagenic poisons, spew out from the Buckeye paper plant. These poisons greatly impact animal, plant, and human health. I first met Joy Ezel at a conference focusing on dioxin more than a decade ago. The conference, sponsored by the great citizen activist organization, Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, documented testimony from many grassroots groups that were and continue to battle corporate polluters. This great environmental justice organization, Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, under the leadership of our friend Lois Gibbs, still helps communities around the nation fight toxic waste sites. Lois, by the way, organized the Love Canal campaign against the infamous Hooker Chemical Company that contaminated her neighborhood in the 1970s. Not too long ago, I had the privilege to be a speaker with Lois Gibbs again at the 25th anniversary Legal Environmental Action Foundation Environmental Justice Conference in Tallahassee, Florida. On my way there, I had the opportunity to again visit the Buckeye plant to witness the paper mill's pollution. The situation that I have briefly described exemplifies many places throughout the world which are under attack by multinational corporations and government land use plans. While my conversation with Joy Ezel focuses on the region now called North Florida, the issues facing her community could be nearly anywhere in the world. Florida, in many ways, is like a so-called third world country. Much of the state is run by a government corporate elite partnership. Forest industries, such as enjoys Taylor County, phosphate mining in central Florida, or agribusinesses such as sugarcane, citrus, vegetables, and even cattle ranching in the region where I live, not to mention unsustainable urbanization, are greatly impacting the environment and human societies. It is also important to remember that Florida is still Dixieland, the Deep South. While there has been some cosmetic change in relations between the races, socioeconomic differences and perhaps more subtle segregation still exists, especially in the region where Joy Ezell is from. This makes her activism very special and very important. Yad Kiddush Native Center is privileged to have Joy Ezell on our program today. Welcome, Joy Ezell. In our conversation, I would like for you to share a little bit of personal background about your experience growing up in rural America, rural Florida. Your very interesting business card underneath your name says environmental activist, the organization HOPE, Help Our Polluted Environment. But I know you also share a lot of common concerns and experiences in even education about rural community development and agriculture, as I did. Would you please share some of your background in agriculture and rural community development, how you worked for chemical companies as a pesticide sales person after college, and that was really the catalyst that got you thinking and got you to become an environmental activist?
Grew up in Perry, Florida, up in Taylor County, up in North Florida. Grew up on a farm, went off to school and studied agricultural business, and went to work for a chemical company and sold some of the worst agricultural chemicals that there were known to man, some FMC Ag Chemicals. This is the company that I worked for first. Got to learn a whole lot about different kinds of chemicals and what they did, and I was afraid that I was ruining the environment. And this was way back in the 70s now, so it was a long time ago. I got really worried about what I was doing about the environment, and I thought that I was doing the wrong thing. And so I went back to school and got my master's, and unfortunately I went to work for another chemical company and sold even worse chemicals than I did to start off with. But it taught me a whole lot, because when I moved back home in 1981, first thing my grandmother told me was that the water was polluted at home in Taylor County. And I said, "What are you talking about, Mama?" And she said, "Well, Buckeye's in the water. You know, you can't drink the water down here anymore because it's got Buckeye." And what she meant was the paper mill effluent was in the water, that they had contaminated the aquifer. And so consequently, our well water was contaminated. And I couldn't believe that nobody was, you know, raising all kinds of holy hell about it, but nobody was saying a word. It was very, very a quiet thing, and only really a very few people actually knew about it. So I started asking questions, and I found out that some of those chemicals that were in our water were very similar to some of the chemicals that I had been selling for all those years. My son was about 12 years old at that time, and his name was Trey. And every day when I took him to school or took him back home from school, we had to cross the Finn Holloway River, and that's the river that's so polluted from the mill. And he would look at me, and he would say, "Mama, why don't you make him clean up that river? It's so nasty, it's so black, and it's so ugly, it's so polluted." And, you know, kids think you can do everything in the world, and I just kind of passed it off for a while there, and I said, "Yeah, sure, Trey, you know, I'll get to that. That'll be my next project." He kept on at me until I really did get interested in it. So I started asking questions. I made a trip to back then to the DER, and of course they didn't want to talk to me. And I went and made a trip up to Atlanta to the EPA, and they pretty much wanted to just brush me aside and get me out of there. The more I learned, the more upset I became, and the more convinced I was that we had a really, really bad problem in Taylor County with the river. So that's what got me started on all my environmental work. I remember the day in 1986 that I found out that the dioxin that was being sent out from the mill in the effluent was exactly the same chemical as Agent Orange. And that was a very depressing day for me, because back then there was hardly anybody for me to talk to at home about that kind of thing. You know, nobody wanted to talk to me about it. It was a taboo subject in Taylor County. You just didn't criticize the mill, because that was where everybody worked, the main source of income for people there, the only big employer in the county. And you just didn't really want to criticize them very much, or you'd be blacklisted. And when I finally did sort of come out of the closet about it and become vocal about it, the local paper called me an armed radical environmental terrorist. And when they called me that, I knew I was doing the right thing. I knew I was making points and doing what I should be doing. I was on the right track. I met Onis years ago. We've been to several environmental meetings together. We were at the dioxin meeting in Tallahassee years ago together. We were both at Cassini demonstration back in 89. We've been to several different kinds of environmental and peace meetings through the years, and I'm so pleased to be with y'all today.
My next question focuses on the situation facing coastal areas that are also being polluted and destroyed, such as the Gulf of Mexico that makes up the entire west coast of Florida. This marine ecosystem is in serious peril. A once plentiful ocean fishery that sustained coastal communities is now threatened. Fish populations have crashed. Estuaries, which function as nurseries for sea life, have lost much of their seagrasses and mangroves. The majority of biologically important saltwater marshes have also been destroyed. Many once beautiful, vibrant undersea coral reefs have been lost. Previously, clean, healthy littoral zones have lost their water quality as a result of surface runoff of sediments and toxic effluents from the land. This has created major dead zones, several larger than New Jersey or Massachusetts. Toxic red tide has seemed to increase in frequency, duration, and area of impact. Most biologists, like myself, blame excessive loading of toxic pollutants as a reason for red tide algae blooms that kill marine life and make people sick. Industrial pollution is one of the primary culprits. Earlier in our conversation, we mentioned that pollution from BG&E's Buckeye paper mill, such as carcinogenic dioxin, ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. Other serious sources of pollution include chemical runoff from agriculture, phosphate mine effluent, oil pollution from refineries and offshore oil rigs, and toxins from chemical industries along the coast. Sadly, ocean dumping is still going on. There are also many hazardous toxic waste Superfund sites along the coastal zone that impact the Gulf of Mexico. It is also important to mention how population growth and urbanization has greatly contributed to the dying of the Gulf of Mexico. Florida's demographics have increased rapidly, creating wild and unbridled development. Approximately 1,000 people a week move to the Sunshine State. Once small coastal villages and rural areas are now major urban areas. Human impacts on the environment is more than what natural ecosystems can handle. Even development of areas away from coastal Florida mean loss of inland wetlands that once acted as natural water filters. Cities along the west coast have greatly impacted the coastal zone. Most barrier islands have also been paved over for housing development. One of the sad examples of that here in southwest Florida in the last 25 years is that the local fishing economy, which largely was based on mullet fishing, many of the mullet fishermen who have been fishing the waters in small skiffs for generations, who did fish sustainably with minimal biological impact to the coastal ecology, have been blamed for the collapse of the fisheries, where much of the problem, from my point of view and other reputable biologists, is, quote, overdevelopment, destruction of mangrove habitat, destruction of seabed habitat, not to mention the cementing of once beautiful littoral zones for urbanization. And while it's true that some commercial fishing is responsible for the biological and economic impacts, I find that, at least here in southwest Florida, many of the small-scale rural family fishing folks have been the scapegoats and have been blamed for a much larger reason of the collapse of the ecology and economy of the coastal Florida. Would you talk about that in the north part of the state?
You're exactly right. The sustainable fishermen, I'm going to call this, are not responsible for all this. You know, we have the net ban, in effect. That was a big controversy a few years ago. If you went off the coast 30 miles, you saw the great big fishing trawlers from other countries out there with huge, miles-long nets. They would cause more destruction of the habitat and cause more fish kill in a day's time than all of the sustainable fishermen put together over a long period of time. The habitat itself, if you think about where the Finn Holloway, for instance, it empties into the Gulf of Mexico, there's 20 square miles of dead seagrasses there. And that part of Florida, up in the northern Gulf of Mexico region of Florida, is supposed to be the richest estuary in the world. It was at one time. But the pulp and paper mills, the development that's coming, if they haven't already, they're going to make a terrible, terrible effect on the estuaries. If you think about the Apalachicola River coming down through Georgia, some of the towns use it for water supply. Some of them use it to dump sewage into. There are industries that dump their effluent right into the Apalachicola River, and it comes down to the Gulf of Mexico, and that is where the great oyster beds are, or were. If you look at the Mississippi River, there's a huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. We're killing the Gulf of Mexico with our activities, and we must stop. And I know a lot of people don't believe in global warming, but in some ways it may be a blessing, because it's going to put an end to a lot of things, bad things that have been going on in the Gulf of Mexico. When the water rises, maybe it's going to stop some of the development, because they won't be able to develop where it's covered over with water. Well, won't that be a blessing? But what's happening up in our area in North Florida is that all the land along the coastline is about to be developed. The company that was St. Joe Paper Company is now St. Joe Land Development. They own thousands and thousands of acres along the coastline, and they are just before putting a condo or a home on almost every inch of that buildable land. And when I say buildable, some of that's really not buildable, but they're getting permits to be able to build on it. They have so much political clout. They have so much money. Even our governor is a part of the thing. They are going to get exactly what they want, exactly when they want it. They've been able to co-opt some of the environmental groups, like I said a little before, about the Thousand Friends of Florida and the Nature Conservancy. They've worked hand-in-hand with the St. Joe Land Development Company to develop places that should not be developed. They have people who are very much involved with those groups and who are also involved with the building companies themselves. And it's a real shame to see the last undeveloped part of Florida suddenly become a wasteland looking just like it does in South Florida, where there are too many homes, too many condos. There's no coastline anymore. You don't have access to the coast once you get these big condos built. And that's what's breaking in Florida, in North Florida. That's what's going to happen here before long. And it's a real shame to see things going that way. If you could go back 100 years and go and see the coastline of North Florida, you'd be so impressed, because it was so beautiful, so gorgeous. It wasn't polluted. There wasn't a condo every 5 feet, you know, so that you could see the coast and you could actually be there. And the estuary was very rich before all this development and before the pollution came about. It's really affecting the lives of the local people, and that many of them are starting to realize that you shouldn't eat as much fish as we used to eat. And people in Florida eat more fish and seafood than other people in other states do, because we do live close to the coast. And it's more readily available to us than it is, say, to somebody in Kansas. So we do consume more fish and seafood. And what should be good for you is turning into be a bad thing. It's not good for you. And that's the wrong way. I mean, we should educate people as to how much fish to eat, but at the same time, we should be working to make those fish be clean and safe to eat.
As we're talking about the ocean and coastal ecosystems and fisheries and marine life, it brings up to my mind, I find scary, push of what's now called aquaculture, commercial fish farming, up in the northeast, again, where I come from, the sacred, beautiful marine ecosystem, and what's now called the Maritimes, North Atlantic region. There's a real serious effort on the part of commercial ocean fish farming, salmon hatcheries as example, and they are actually using a lot of marine life, a lot of so-called wild fish species that are caught in order to make into fish pellet food for the so-called commercial farm-raised fish. And this whole aquaculture, marine fishing industry's public relations push really gives the appearance that this is a panacea for protecting, quote, the wild native ocean marine fish stocks, against their argument that that will protect so-called open littoral zone fisheries that are under threat, and also that this will be a benefit to a protein-starved planet that needs to feed more people. What you're not told is that a lot of the aquaculture systems are also very toxic. I know this might not be your area of expertise. It is not mine. However, we as environmentalists, I'm sure, have some familiarity and concern about this. Would you share any comments you have?
Yes, it's something I'm very concerned about. I don't know as much about it as I would like to, and I do need to learn more about that. Anything I think that's not natural is not a good thing. So I don't understand how this commercial fish farming operations could possibly be resulting in safe fish for people to eat or sustainable fish for people to eat. Anytime that you co-opt a natural system and do it another way, you're messing up, I believe. You're making a mistake. And I believe that eventually they're going to find out that this is not a good thing to do. In the first place, the water is not safe. Because we've allowed so much pollution, any place where they're doing this commercial fish farming, those fishes are being grown, or seafood, whatever kind it is they're growing, are not being grown in safe water. And when you grow something in a polluted, unsafe atmosphere like that, you're not going to get a good result. We should all be aware of where our food's coming from, and anytime you buy something in the supermarket, you ought to look at the label and see where it does come from. And I'm all for labeling everything as to their country or area of origin, so that at least consumers would know. It's interesting, along the coast of Taylor County, I'll go back to something I really do know about. Along the coast of Taylor County, it's legal to go scalloping. You can gather the scallops in the summer. Starting July the 1st, the scallop season starts. But it's against the law to gather oysters. And people will look at me and they have a question mark on their face. You can say, well, how is that? Well, it's regulated by two different parts of DEP. It's the only difference that I can find. They're both bivalves. They both filter the water as they grow. The scallops can move. They do scoot along the bottom. And oysters are pretty much stationary. But basically, they're the same kind of organism, grown in the same kind of water, grown in the same polluted places, but it's legal to gather the scallops, but not the oysters. You will actually get a ticket from the Marine Patrol or the Wildlife Agency if you go out and gather oysters along the coast of Taylor County. Now, the area was exempt from the Coastal Zone Management Act way back a long time ago. Procter & Gamble exercised their power up in Congress and got that whole area exempt from the Coastal Zone Management Area. And that in itself prohibits the state of Florida and the federal government from holding any agency or any polluter to any kind of rule that might be on the books, because it's exempt from the Coastal Zone Management Act. And that's something right there, if you think about it. You know, why is that? Why should that to this day still be in effect? That should be lifted. That should be taken off, so that all of the coastline along there is protected.
In the Pacific Northwest, for example, the tribal homelands of a number of coastal indigenous tribal nations, one of the largest aquaculture industries is now Weyerhaeuser Paper Company. So that in itself should be a red flag, and I just thought I'd add that as a little commentary. I'm always someone that always tries to think also about the interconnections, not only with the environment, but also energy. And right now, our wonderful governor, Governor Bush, the president's brother, has publicly, at least for the time being, a campaign promise not to allow so-called offshore energy development. I'm wondering where you are not too far from the coastal zone, and we're talking about this, whether you see the end of his term in office or the future administration, state of Florida, the federal government, if there's going to be a serious push in terms of offshore oil and natural gas, other type of so-called energy resource exploitation of the coastal zone.
Years ago, the state actually gave the oil rights away to some of the oil companies. They gave oil leases along the coast of Florida to companies way back 50, 60, 70 years ago. So if you buy land on the coast now, you need to check and make sure that you have the oil rights, because you may not. That may have already been gone long away before you ever even had a chance to even think about that. Yes, I'm very much afraid that they are going to have a push now to do more oil, to do oil drilling along our coastline in Florida. The Bush administration seems intent upon getting oil any place that they can possibly find it, and giving it to the oil companies. It's interesting how they use the tax money to do all this exploration and do all this preliminary work, and then suddenly privatize all these kind of things and just give it over to companies that are just going to make money with it. I'm very much concerned about the coastline of Florida being used for oil drilling. I don't think that's right. I think that our, at least we have a good argument that we can bring forth about the tourism. We do have a good argument in Florida that we can put forth, and that tourism brings in many, many more dollars than almost any other industry in Florida. And we can say, wait a minute, you can't affect tourism by putting in these oil drilling rigs right off the coast of Florida, because it would ruin our tourism. So at least we have that argument. But we all need to be very, very vigilant and not allow any oil drilling along our coastline.
With one man, you mess with the whole, and soon there'll be nothing to mess with at all, because we're all interconnected. We better make a move, so if we drive all our fancy cars, and if we cut down all our trees, we're gonna drown in the acid showers, yeah, yeah, we'll choke on the smog and the breeze. Maybe we'll be stirred into a radical change. It's gonna take a lot of effort, it could be arranged, because we're all interconnected. We better make a move, so you will see that beer going buzzing by. Well, she's an integral part of you and I. You walk through the mountains, majestic and tall. You start to realize that we're incredibly small. All the fish in the ocean, all the birds in the sky. Can we live in this madness or watch the world die? Because we're all interconnected. We better make a move. Yes, we're all interconnected. The earth and the sun and the moon. Yes, we're all interconnected. And we'll find out very soon that if we mess with one, then we mess with the whole, and soon there'll be nothing to mess with at all, because we're all interconnected. We better make a move. Ba-da-doo-da-da. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat Kitichi Native Center. Yat Kitichi Native Center defends Mother Earth and the cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Yat Kitichi Native Center is an intertribal, culture and arts, environmental protection, social justice, and news media organization. Yat Kitichi Native Center portrays Native peoples and their world views in a more accurate and in-depth depiction of both our ancestral and contemporary cultures. Yat Kitichi Native Center serves to educate by providing a deeper understanding of our diverse cultures, arts, values, histories, and contemporary situations. Yat Kitichi tries to honor traditional ways by instilling an appreciation and respect for Mother Earth and tribal peoples throughout the world. Yat Kitichi Native Center educates the public on important issues facing Indigenous communities. We work in support of intertribal, cultural, environmental, and social justice issues by networking with other organizations and events which share our concerns. Yat Kitichi Native Center serves as a focal point for Native news and information. We maintain a documentary library for networking with the Native and international press. Yat Kitichi Native Center's Speakers Bureau provides spokespersons for school programs, conference speakers, and community presentations. Yat Kitichi Native Center is experienced in planning, promoting Native forums, symposiums, powwows, and cultural events. Yat Kitichi's Mishkwinataki Environment Program protects Mother Earth through conservation and restoration projects. Yat-Kedichi's Environmental Education Program focuses on curriculum development, teacher training, and nature field trips. We are members of the professional organization, the North American Association of Environmental Education. Yat-Kedichi's Kinonwatakwasin Native Arts creates quality handcrafted traditional and contemporary fine arts. Please request our catalog of custom flutes, pottery, beaded necklaces, bracelets, earrings, leather pouches, hat bands, and chokers with bone. Yat-Kedichi Native Center's Wolf Mountain Radio Program, Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, honors Native American and Indigenous peoples throughout the world by being a voice for our ancestors, contemporary, and future generations. Please write us for our catalog of audio tapes available for purchase. Native peoples throughout the world are concerned for the well-being of sacred Mother Earth, tribal sovereignty, and respect for cultural lifeways. If you appreciate hearing Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, we ask you, our listeners, to help financially support our program to stay on the air. Wolf Mountain Radio is an all-volunteer production. Any financial contribution to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices will be greatly appreciated. We thank you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Please feel free to contact us about our consulting services, or if you or your organization is interested in hosting a speaker or educational forum. To contact Yat-Kedichi Native Center, write to Yat-Kedichi Native Center, 1731 16th Avenue Northeast, Naples, Florida, 34120, USA. Yat-Kedichi Native Center sincerely thanks you. Aho, Kinowatakwasin, to all of our relations.
The music you heard prior to our Yat-Kedichi Native Center program identification was a flute song from Robert Reed Cody and Hovaya Edwards off their Canon Records CD, Reflections. The name of the song was Buffalo Prayer Song. We started our music set off with environmental singer-songwriter Rosie Emery's special song entitled We're All Interconnected, the title track of her CD. As many of our worldwide listeners know, Rosie Emery is a co-founder with Dr. Susan Carter and myself of the Wauchatchobe Earth Charter Project, whose purpose is to promote earth ethics and to inspire everyone to be concerned for the future well-being of our planet. You can find out more about the Wauchatchobe Earth Charter Project, our environmental and multicultural education program, on our website. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the bombing of Greenpeace's ship, the Rainbow Warrior, in the Maori homeland Aotearoa, now called New Zealand. I want to play a new segment from Democracy Now, where host Amy Goodman presents information on the French government's attack 25 years ago on the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbor. Greenpeace was actively protesting nuclear testing in the South Pacific, an issue of great concern to us here at Yat-Kedichi Native Center. Indigenous islanders and ocean life have greatly suffered from nuclear testing from colonial countries such as France and the United States. Please listen now to this Democracy Now! News feature.
Greenpeace flagship Rainbow Warrior was bombed by the French government and sunk in a harbor in Auckland, New Zealand. The ship was preparing to head to sea to protest French nuclear bomb tests in the South Pacific. Greenpeace photographer Fernando Pereira was killed in the attack. Last weekend, the French newspaper Le Monde revealed the late French president, François Mitterrand, personally approved the sinking of the ship. The paper obtained a handwritten account of the operation written by the former head of France's spy agency, Steve Lacoste. He describes his meeting with Mitterrand 2 months before the attack. At that meeting, he asked Mitterrand for permission to conduct the bombing. Lacoste wrote, Mitterrand, quote, gave me his consent while emphasizing the importance he placed placed on the nuclear tests. Two members of the 13-person French Secret Service team that carried out the bombing were arrested 2 days later. Dominique Prier and Alain Marfart were sentenced to 10 years in prison, but were extradited to French Polynesia, where they served less than three. Others who carried out the bombing have apparently escaped punishment. The man who coordinated the operation, Louis-Pierre Dillet, a former lieutenant colonel in the French Secret Service, is now living in Washington, D.C., and working for the giant Belgian arms maker, F.H. Herstal. The company sells weapons to the United States Special Forces and to New Zealand's Defense Forces. We're joined on the phone now from New Zealand by David Roby, independent journalist who was on board the ship on its last journey and wrote Eyes of Fire, The Last Voyage of the Rainbow Warrior. New updated edition of the book is being released this week. He's also an associate professor in Auckland University of Technology School of Communication Studies. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, David Roby.
Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you respond to this latest news, the handwritten memo that describes the approval of the French President François Mitterrand for the blowing up of the ship?
Well, it's been largely received in New Zealand with a sort of a certain amount of ho-hum. Well, we thought so all along. Most of the reaction, certainly in New Zealand, is that, well, you know, it was no surprise. You know, people have more or less accepted for the best part of 20 years that, although it was not, you know, absolutely certain before that Mitterrand had actually sort of authorized the attack, it's been more or less accepted in New Zealand that was probably the case. It's just interesting that Sir Geoffrey Palmer, who was the Deputy Prime Minister in New Zealand at the time of the bombing, said his reaction when confronted with this news from Le Monde, he said it's very disappointing that because one would not expect the President of a friendly nation to authorize an illegal act against a nation with whom you enjoy friendly relations and with whom you have fought in two world wars. That seems to me to be rather extraordinary. So that was Sir Geoffrey Palmer's reaction.
This past weekend, there was this memorial at the Rainbow Warrior. Can you talk about what happened, who was there, and also about the Greenpeace photographer who was killed?
Well, Fernando, he in fact had a cabin just very close. I was on board for something like 10 weeks up until the time of the bombing, but I'd actually left a couple of nights before, because after the Rainbow Warrior arrived in New Zealand, my home is actually in Auckland, so I'd actually gone ashore. It's good to get ashore for a while. With the 20th anniversary, Fernando's daughter, who was 8 at the time, that he died, she came out for the voyage of the new Rainbow Warrior going up to Matari Bay, where the original ship was sunk to make a living reef. Well, Fernando's daughter Morel came up on this voyage, and it was a very moving, a very emotional time for her. It was an opportunity to talk to crew members, and also she addressed the local Māori iwi, the tribe, and the Greenpeace people and many other peace supporters and so on that came up for the ceremony.
The mission of the Rainbow Warrior, can you talk about that and how it applies to what is happening today, David Roby?
Well, I mean, the irony today, I think, is that, you know, 20 years ago, this was an act of state terrorism, yet the major powers of the era, the US, Britain, and so on, and even Australia, gave no reaction whatsoever to this extraordinary attack, you know, on a sovereign nation, a friendly sovereign nation, with 30 nations operating in the country as part of the attack. And in this context of war on terror today, it just seems extraordinary that so little attention was given to that. And the legacy of the period of nuclear testing, although France subsequently stopped nuclear testing in 1996 when it signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, there's still the unresolved problem of the Tahitians that were subjected to radioactive fallout during the period of atmospheric testing in French Polynesia. And another aspect, of course, with the Rainbow Warrior was that immediately prior to being bombed, it was actually on a voyage to the Marshall Islands, where it resettled a number of Wongalap Islanders. In fact, the whole community on Wongalap Atoll were moved to another island. And the reason they did this was because they were subjected to nuclear radiation during the 1950s, when the United States was doing atmospheric testing in the Marshall Islands.
We're talking to David Roby, who was on the last journey of the Eyes of Fire before it was blown up by the French government, by French intelligence agents. Do you think President François Mitterrand should be charged for the explosion and for the death of the photographer?
Well, the fact is that you know, there's a lot of bitter, you know, sort of feeling left in New Zealand as a result of the fact that only two of those agents were arrested, and of course they were sentenced to 10 years for manslaughter for the death of Fernando Pereira, and also for willful damage to the Greenpeace ship. And of course what really happened was through a brokered trade deal and mediation from the United Nations at the time, France did apologize and it did pay over $13 million in compensation to the New Zealand government. But in return, New Zealand handed over these two agents to the French authorities, and they were whisked off to Howell Atoll in French Polynesia, which was the military base supporting the nuclear testing at Mururoa. Well, of course, Howell Atoll was rather something like a military club med, and both Alain Maffar and Dominique Preux only served there in exile for probably less than 2 years.
David Roby, we have to wrap up.
To France's heroes.
But we have to wrap up, and of course with Mitterrand dead, I mean members of his administration, but also the head of French intelligence, Louis-Pierre Villet, the former lieutenant colonel in French Secret Service, now living in Washington and working for the giant Belgian arms maker F.H. Erstal. It's interesting, he's selling weapons to, well, your own defense department to the New Zealand.
Well, dear friends, we are just about out of time for this edition of Wolf Mountain Native Radio. We want to thank our very special guest, Joy Ezell, for sharing her spirit with us on honoring Mother Earth and Indigenous voices. All across the globe, there are wonderful Earth justice warriors like Joy who are working for a better world. One of the ways in which people of culture are supporting each other is through ceremony, such as sacred runs. Within Indian country, many indigenous peoples and our allies join together in prayer runs to honor Mother Earth. We conclude today's program with a sacred run song by American Indian Movement warrior Dennis Banks, who coordinates a number of sacred runs in different places on Mother Earth. Until the next Wolf Mountain Radio, this is your host and producer, Ones Pritzker, thanking you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Aho, Kinawantakwasin, to all of our relations.
The run song, which was adopted in 1992 when we ran across America.